I am Gaius, John Batchelor, with Germanicus Marcovleos. First century AD, 91 AD, the spring of. It's a beautiful time down by the Thames. People shopping, rushing on home. We're very secure, and we're talking about the 21st century that is not secure. NATO. Germanicus outlines a scenario, credible scenario, where the Russians could roll up to the Danube through Odessa, take Odessa Oblast, and surround Moldova, right up to the Danube. Across the Danube is Romania. That's NATO. So we have now to entertain what NATO's been saying these last weeks, looking at the battlefield. The leader of Estonia, the smallest of the three Baltic states, is under an arrest warrant out of Russia. Her response, her name is Kallas, is that we're next on Putin's menu. The leader of Italy, Giorgia Meloni, very popular at home, but a troubled nation for going in one direction. She's also the chair of G7. She has spoken that there will be no approval of NATO troops into Ukraine in any event, meaning to contravene remarks by the president of France, Mr. Macron. So Italy says no. Kallas of Estonia says we're in trouble. Moldova doesn't make one statement, just says we're surrounded. Romania is alert. It's permitting NATO to build a very large base near the Danube, and, well, it's both Danube and Black Sea, if you look at your map of Romania. Constanza is in the northeast part of the state. Right across the river is Moldova. And Ukraine, right across the river. And that river is the exit point for the grain and other foodstuffs coming out of Ukraine. So, Germanicus, we have a battlefield in which from the north, in the Baltics, they're convinced Russia's coming. In the south, you mention that Russia's coming, and certainly the basing at Constanza anticipates that. NATO is ready or not, but Russia has always thought it's at war with NATO. My concern is that we're watching the escalation cycle right in front of us. Is that correct?
We first have to ask ourselves the question, why is there an escalation cycle that is becoming so hysterical and so intense? And the reason is, as has been confessed by American, German, British, and French leaders, is that they expect Ukraine to crumble in the next few months. Certainly before the fall of this year. And they don't know what to do. And the responses tell you a lot about where they're coming from in terms of how they cope with this situation. So, for example, Macron sees the identity and reputation of La Belle France as being at stake. The La Grande Nation is going to be humbled yet again, and he doesn't want that to happen. He wants to carry on in the tradition of, say, de Gaulle. Then you have the small states on the front line, whether it's Poland, which is not such a small state, or Slovakia, or certainly the Baltics, especially Estonia, and to an extent, I guess, Romania, they want to take some action. I think the Baltics are tremendously aggressive right now because they see themselves as easy prey. They're very tiny countries. I don't mean in terms of surface area, but they have populations that are like the size of Rhode Island. And 20% of their populations, at least for Estonia and Latvia, are Russian. So they're desperate right now. And so what I think we're seeing are different degrees of desperation. Britain is desperate because it has staked out a role of leadership in helping America bring down Russia. But the U.S. is desperate because a collapse of Ukraine would mean the end of blue hopes in the upcoming election in November. It's a tapestry or a mosaic of different kinds of desperation. And the problem, which is a kind of a rogue variable, is that all of these different desperations, which come from different places, could lead to all sorts of impulsive choices that in themselves might create a kind of concatenation of bad decisions. This is exactly what happened in the July crisis in 1914. Now, people in Europe didn't want to go to war, and the regimes that supposedly represented them didn't want to go to war, but they were fearful. And as things developed, they became more and more hysterical in the moment. And this is the biggest problem, I think, that we face, is hysteria in the moment. When you're hysterical in the moment, you impulsively or reflexively make decisions without the benefit of judgment. And this is, I think, the biggest concern for the West today, because it's not a problem of escalation in any sort of mediated, rational kind of consideration. This is a set of polities, each of which has its own needs and desires and fears and paranoia, and all of those lead them in different ways to make bad decisions. And that's what I feel is the biggest threat or challenge today to the peace of Europe, is things just going in the wrong direction suddenly and impulsively.
Let me use an example. The attack on Moscow. We know very little about why, how, who. There are a lot of finger pointing. Tajikistan, ISIS, the agency, FSB, Ukraine, a lot of finger-pointing. But it was out of nowhere, like a black swan. It led to the murder and the burning, and certainly worldwide television. It reminded me immediately of the Reichstag fire, immediately, which was a fire that came from out of nowhere but was very useful for statements by Berlin and others afterwards. We're seeing statements out of Moscow right now saying they were fleeing towards Ukraine. Whether it's true or not, the statements are useful because it's a way of rallying. That also is the escalation cycle. Do you agree, Germanicus?
Flagrant incidents are the touchstone, like the match on the fuse. That is, in fact, going back to the July crisis in 1914, that fuse was lit by the assassination of the Archduke and his wife. So this attack was a black swan only in the sense that it is part of that rogue variable. But in the sense of it being deliberate, it was not a black swan at all. And you have to ask yourself, cui bono? Who benefits from making this attack? Who would want to make this attack in order to achieve effects in Russia that would demoralize Russia, make Putin look weak, expose their inability to prevent such an attack, and in many ways simply regain a sense of the initiative? Who would be those parties that would have benefited? Why would they want to do it?
I have the answer. It's the black hand, Germanicus.
The black hand, sure. And, you know, it's very convenient to bring up ISIS here, but the parties that would benefit, it's very much like the Nord Stream pipeline desecration. Who benefited? Who wanted to do it? It always comes down to that. And if like Sherlock Holmes, or Agatha Christie, you go down that path and figure out, well, who's the one who really would benefit from this? Then you come up with answers eventually. We can't do that yet. Hopefully we will.
I only introduced it because it's suggestive that we're vulnerable to things we can't explain, but then that can be used for agitprop immediately. And that's what we're witnessing now.
Yes, absolutely. We're in a position where stratagems and perverse operations that are hardwired into the genetic makeup and DNA of certain kinds of agencies and institutions, you know, like special forces, like CIAs, like all of those groups that are just constantly doing what they're supposed to do in a situation that's extremely unstable, that is brittle, that is in a kind of hysterical emotional state. For them to be doing what they do can lead to these kinds of outcomes where a single thing, we go back to the Serbian Secret Service in 1914. Sure, they wanted to get at Austria-Hungary, and they had their agent, Gavrilo Princip, and it worked out for them. But they were doing their job within the compass of the small bubble in which they operated. And yet in achieving success in that operation, everything went to hell.
Has Europe changed since 1914? Or is it the same Europe, the tribal chauvinism?
It's totally different. It's totally different because the tribalism in Western Europe has gone. If we want to use a sort of quote-unquote primitive characterization, what you had in Europe in 1914 was a predominance of religious nationalism, where you had nations jockeying against one another, harboring resentments and desires, you know, revanchism in France, the Italia Irredenta, the fears of the Germans, the pan-Slavism of the Russians and the Serbs. All of that was a combustible mix, ready to go to war. You had millions of young men willing to sacrifice themselves on the altar of religious nationalism. Today, Western Europe is played out. It's hollowed out. It's empty. These are, as T.S. Eliot would say in The Hollow Men, headpieces filled with straw, alas. And yet, in other parts of Europe farther to the east, especially Russia, you have the old sense of nationalism and more traditional visions of the nation still alive and strong. And I think this is what creates the incredible disproportion in capability and effectiveness between NATO and Russia. It really, in the end, is not about technology or even production of weapons. It's about a sense of identity, focus, shared will, willingness to sacrifice that you see in Russia on one hand, and the kind of petulant, narcissistic world of ruling elites in the EU and NATO that are suddenly coming to terms with the fact that they're leading societies that are turning against them, as we see in the revolts going on in France, Netherlands, Germany, Britain with Brexit, Italy as well. You have a very brittle and weak Western Europe.
Will NATO meet in Brussels and watch Kyiv surrender? Will they do that? Are they ready for that? Are they building up for that?
This is, I can give you an answer that isn't an answer, but it's the best that can be given at the moment. If elites are threatened, and I'm talking about the EU, NATO elites, if they're threatened with a collapse of their power, with their delegitimation, they will do incredibly stupid, impulsive, self-destructive things. This is true of elites everywhere throughout civilized time. And the problem is they will at some point, and I say this again and again, they will at some point in the next 6 months be brought to that place. And we cannot expect them to behave rationally. The fact that the president of France could suggest sending a corps that he doesn't even have to send into Ukraine, where it would be attacked and destroyed and lead to an escalation to World War III, the fact that he could say that on national television, and anyone can view that video, is amazing to me. It's a sign of the precarity of elites in Europe today. And also, it is a ratification of historical truth. And that truth is that when elites are under stress and feel they're under siege and are convinced that they're about to be overthrown, they do incredibly desperate and reckless things.
I think you just said yes. I think you just said yes. I'm going to leave it there. I'll take the qualified yes for this moment. Brussels is watching. Kyiv is without resources, without adequate supply. Burns says they're going to give up huge amounts of territory. I don't know how much, maybe all the way to Odessa. And that was last week's news. The refinery attacks, Washington has asked Kyiv to cut it out, and Kyiv is continuing the attacks. Putin says that's a war crime, attacking the infrastructure of civilians. And by definition, it is. And so the responses over the next week will be part of the escalation cycle. Will NATO intervene? Is the question we're going to leave hanging. Germanicus is Michael Vlahos. I am Gaius, John Batchelor. We're first century AD Roman citizens. And when we come back, fraying emperors. We worry about them. We've got one, Domitian, right now, the last of the Vespasians. There's a fraying emperor in the 2nd century AD named Hadrian. And I've been reading about the education of Marcus Aurelius, who was a teenager under Hadrian, and looking forward to his time as the emperor. But asking myself, how can you tell an emperor is fraying? How can you tell he's in decline? Is it age? Is it temperament? Is it the times? When we come back. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.